This week on Retronauts, we don't know Dick. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Retronauts in the far-off year of 2019. Holographic Anna de Armas wives are still 26 years away, but we're all hanging in there. And this time, we're going to be talking about Blade Runner, the 1982 movie that's all about turtle flipping, and it went on to shape the world in sci-fi forever. And, of course, I am your host for this one, Bob Skinjob Mackey. And before I go any further, who is here with me today? Let's go in alphabetical order around the virtual room here. So I'll let you folks figure that out. It's 9 a.m. right now for me, so I don't really know the alphabet very well.
Hey, you think I'd be here if I could afford a real snake? It's Henry Gilbert.
Kevin Bunch, noted Andy.
Hi, I'm Stuart Jip, and I was looking forward to making the first dick joke, but boom, there we go, right in the intro. I got nothing, folks. That's all I had.
It hit me the second I started doing these notes, so I apologize. We're off to a great start here. But yes, we today are going to be talking about the first Blade Runner movie. I'm sure we'll be touching upon the second one because I just watched that last night for the first time, and maybe very briefly touching upon some of the games. But honestly, the world of Blade Runner games is not super interesting because we have one game technically based on the soundtrack because they couldn't get the rights to the movie. Very funny. We have the Westwood point-and-click adventure game, which honestly could be an episode, and I still really want to play that game. And then the third game is a somewhat recent game, but it's for a discontinued Google VR platform that I think can no longer be accessed. So the world of Blade Runner games is not that deep, but hey, the movie itself and what it touched is a very much could be an entire podcast series, but we're going to limit it to one podcast here. Before I go any further, let's talk about our experience with Blade Runner. Let's start with Stuart. Stuart, what is your experience with running Blades?
Oh, God, I think that the listeners are going to want to punch me full in the face after this, but I only watched it for the first time yesterday. I think it's important to have that perspective. Obviously, I know everything about the movie by cultural osmosis because it's one of those movies, you know. Like, if you've seen basically any anime, you've seen pretty much seen Blade Runner, I think. That's right. If you've seen K-On!, you've seen it, but no. I mean, this is. I don't want to get off on this sour note, but, you know, it's an incredible-looking film. It's obviously incredibly influential. It's beautifully shot. It's just so many sequences that just look absolutely marvelous. It's really well acted. And I just kind of was sitting there like, this is bollocks. This makes no sense, but I'm having a good time watching it. But then I was informed that there's a version of the movie that explains all the stuff that makes no sense in voiceover. And I was like, hey, that sounds pretty good. And they were like, no, it's bad. It's bad when you know what's happening. I was like, okay, I believe you, but I do wonder if it's a sort of Donnie Darko situation where they really do ruin the movie by explaining everything. I don't know, but I enjoyed watching it, and I would consider it incredibly impressive for the time when it came out. You know, it doesn't. Having said that, I did watch the final cut, so maybe they've massively changed it up from how it originally looked. I don't know, maybe they made it all teal and orange or whatever. They probably have actually done that, because it did look pretty teal and orange. Yeah, I think it's a movie that deserves sort of the acclaim that it's got. I wouldn't call it the most narratively coherent movie, regardless of how it's spun or edited or saying this is the right version, this is the wrong version. I don't know. I thought it was pretty enjoyable overall, and I can see why it had such a cultural, I understand it wasn't an immediate cultural sort of awakening, but it did eventually come to influence so many hundreds of thousands of things. I can see why.
Okay, let's move on to Kevin. How about you, Kevin? What is your Blade Runner experience?
So the first time I saw it was way back when I was an undergrad in college. I was in a film studies class. They had a whole list of movies you could choose from to watch a couple of them. I picked Blade Runner because I heard it was pretty good. I was not impressed. I didn't really think it was all that. It was the theatrical cut. That was the version that I was able to find. So I've always been kind of like down on it. I read the book that it was based on a few years later and really enjoyed that. And having gone back and rewatched Blade Runner, the final cut was what I was able to find at the local library. You know, it's better than I remember it being. I don't know that I'm a huge fan of it, but I can certainly see why it was as influential as it was.
And Henry, how about you?
Boy, I guess I didn't think I was the biggest Blade Runner liker on this one, but I think I am. No, I really enjoy Blade Runner. Bob questioned before off mic my 5-star for it on Letterboxd. I have
Henry is on trial right now.
I've adjusted it to 4. It had been a while since I rewatched the whole thing of Final Cut. But
oh, we don't understand this movie, this here Blade Runner, is worth 5 stars, Mr. Gilbert.
Wait a minute. You had it at 5 and you adjusted it to 4 under duress. You should go back and change it back to a 5, Henry.
No. So here was my test last night of watching it, watching Final Cut again for the first time in a while was... I was struggling to keep my eyes open at about the 20-minute point, and I was like, I shouldn't be working this hard to stay awake for a 5-star movie. But then by the end of it, I was like, no, I was ready to redo it as a 3. But then by the end, I was like, okay, I remember what I loved about this. This ending leaves me on a good feeling. But my personal history with Blade Runner was I was a Star Wars nerd growing up, who then everybody, you'd hear the older boys at school say, like, well, you know, there's this other film that stars Harrison Ford that's way cooler and more mature than Star Wars, but also you'll never get to see the real version of it. There's only the crappy version that has a bad ending. They changed the ending and they added a bunch of voiceover to it, and it's way worse. You'll never see the good one. And so then much of the 90s, if you're a nerd, you're waiting for the release of the director's cut. Like, it was one of the most marketed director's cut there was. So you kept hearing, like, oh, this is the greatest, this is the greatest. And then for the 25th anniversary in 2007, that's when the final cut came out. And I saw that in theaters. And perhaps I was still on the high of just having moved to a new town and seeing, wow, I'm going to see Blade Runner in the theaters. I could never see that in my suburban Florida town. And that's why I was like, yeah, 5 stars. But I do give the vibes of it 5 stars. I think it is a 5-star vibes movie that told everybody how to make cool shit in a steampunk future, cyberpunk future. It's early for me too, okay? but
hey,
yeah.
There's lots of steam in this movie.
It is a steamy movie. It's a very steamy movie. But yeah, I'm not just talking about the dancers. Hey, no.
I'll say.
I am positive on Blade Runner, though I actually like all of the things that Blade Runner influenced more than Blade Runner itself. Though I would, if you were to say watch Blade Runner or watch Blade Runner 2049 right now, I would pick watching Blade Runner over 2049, though I really liked Blade Runner 2049.
Okay. Yeah, as for me, I'm going to betray my nerd status as well. I only saw Blade Runner for the first time in July of this year, and I watched it again last night for the show. But I think my stance on it was, well, I've seen all the influences. How could this possibly hold up? But I also, in the back of my mind, felt like, well, this is probably a very good movie. And I've heard some people say, oh, it's actually overrated. But I bet they're not used to slower, more cerebral movies. They're not smart like me. And then I watched it, and I found that, yes, the production design is amazing. It's you cannot even say how much it influenced. It's just in everything that followed from that point onwards. That takes place in the future. Like, everything you see in the future has some ties to Blade Runner and Sid Mead's designs. It's inescapable. But I was also surprised by how straightforward the movie was, how there was no real subtext to the movie. It was just a very surface level. And I was expecting, like, oh, these deep, heavy conversations about what does it mean to be a human and, you know, explorations of that. But it really wasn't that. And we can talk more about my issues with the movie later. But I watched 2049 last night, and I felt like, oh, this is the version of this world I wanted to see. This shows, like, how people live in it. It shows more of the perspectives of the replicants. And there's actually, imagine this, folks. Imagine if you're watching a film noir and there's a mystery to solve. It's not just your boss saying, there's two androids in that building. Go over there. And he's like, okay, sir. That's essentially, I mean, we'll get to it, but Harrison Ford has a great quote about Blade Runner, and he goes back and forth about Blade Runner so much, he's hard to nail down on this movie. But he said his biggest issue with the movie is that it's about a detective who does no detecting, and that's my biggest issue. This is not fun to follow at all from his perspective. I love being with Roy Batty and Pris and all the other replicants, and they have a much more interesting struggle with stakes. But him, he's Mr. Boring Pants. And it's the most easy to follow mystery in the world. In fact, there's no mystery. And 2049, love it. Blade Runner original, I respect it. But I feel like it has a lot of story problems. And Harrison Ford is really bad at it. But hey, he's really good in the sequel.
That's, you know, in 2049, it just felt even slower paced to me. That's why I was like, not just because I can see the minute count of how long it is, but...
But yeah, also, way longer, right? It's like another hour longer.
But it's much slower. It is a better mystery, and I think Ryan Gosling is really good in it too. Like he's really good, and and also I couldn't, after seeing Harrison Ford be contractually obligated to be in Star Wars movies and not care, then he is trying way harder in Blade Runner 2049 than he was in The Force Awakens, which was cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the 2049 discussion, but it's a lot longer. It's about an hour longer, but there is an actual mystery. The only mystery in Blade Runner is when Harrison Ford looks at a snake scale for about 8 minutes.
Oh, hold on a sec. He does use that technology to look around the corner of a photograph or something.
Right, right.
Which is, like, insane. But, you know, it's the future.
Yes, yeah. And somehow that technology exists in 2049, but it's not as tedious as hearing Harrison Ford go, okay, now go three things to the left. Okay, now zoom. Okay, now go up. No, stop. That's about 5 minutes of Blade Runner 1.
I was
one.
So grateful that they showed that whole thing on just Unbroken. I was just sitting there like, there's only 2 hours of this movie, and this is how we're spending 6 of these minutes. Brilliant.
That's actually, if you're in the movie theater, sorry, Kevin, if you're seeing this in the movie theater, and by the way, that's the way I saw Blade Runner. That's the best way to see it, because when I was watching it at home yesterday, I was getting a little, like, listless. But in the theater, when you're trapped in a dark room with all the visuals, it really helps you forget about the story issues. But I will say, if you want to use the bathroom and you're seeing this in the theater, when Harrison Ford starts using Photoshop, go to the concession stand. Sorry, Kevin.
No, I was just going to say that your description of this as a film noir without any mystery is very it's very much how I was feeling about this movie, because it does take a lot away from those, you know, mid-century noir aesthetics and just sort of marrying them to the kind of weird dystopian future vibes of, you know, movies from the 70s like Soylent Green, but it doesn't really do a great job of bringing with it the mysterious aspects of a mystery novel. You kind of see that in the original book too, which I think I'm the only one here who got a chance to read through it.
Movies are better than books. I don't have to read books.
So. That's very gracious of you to say you had a chance, as if it's like not my choice that I didn't read. didn't have time because I was too busy doing fucking nothing. Thank you.
I actually planned to read it, but then time made fool of me. And then, but I will say, on my Goodreads goal for the year, I have read 30 of 50 books. So there you have it, folks.
That's pretty good.
I'm a smart boy.
Would you like a medal, Bob? Would you like a medal?
I know, I want free pizza. This is how it works in America. Oh, shit, I'm in Canada now.
Oh, no. You don't get any Pizza Hut little buttons.
Your book is
no stickers. Yeah, sorry, Kevin. I think you had more to say.
Yes, I was just going to say that the book kind of has a similar thing going on. Like, it is also pulling from a lot of noir mystery novels, and there's, like, a little bit of a mystery, but they get resolved really quickly because it's not really about the mystery. It's definitely more interested in the, you know, sort of discussion of empathy and, you know, what does it mean to be human and or alive, and does that really mean anything, etc.
Could I interject and just say, I know everyone knows this, but just for the sheer sake of information, you are talking about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I don't think we've actually named it, so I thought I'd just get that out.
Well, you know, half the printings of it nowadays just say Blade Runner on them.
Oh, really? Cover, okay. So. And all the listeners are now just like, oh, that's what book came out. Because nobody obviously knew that.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the movie. We're going to talk about the making of the movie very soon here, but I can see people saying that, it's actually subverting the tropes of detective stories, but I really don't think so. Ridley Scott, it was his idea, like, let's turn this into a detective story. He was not trying to subvert anything. He wanted to filter the story through the lens of a classic noir detective, but in a different setting. So, but let's move on to the actual origins of this movie in the book. So, of course, we talked about it just now, but it's based on a book from Philip K. Dick, the 1968 book with a very Philip K. Dick title, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It's very fun to just look at a list of Philip K. Dick book titles. I picked one up recently based on the description, but the name of the book is Cry My Tears, the Policeman Said. So that's really the style of book and short story title that was of in fashion at the time. And, of course, extremely prolific thanks to our little friend called Speed. Philip K. Dick wrote 44 novels and 121 short stories. This is before we could just all, you know, get Adderall in our systems. This is what he had to do. He died in his early 50s for the sake of just cranking out all of these words. And apparently that he was not really made aware of the fact that this was being turned into a movie until they actually started production, but he was really won over when they showed him footage of it before he died. He didn't make it in time for the premiere of this movie, but he saw about 20 minutes, and he told Ridley Scott, like, oh, you captured what is inside of my head, and you put it on the screen. So they should have told him up front, but after the fact, he was like, hey, cool, I like where this is going, and then he passed away before the movie could come out.
There's been like 80 movies based on Philip K. Dick since this one came out. Like, he is, and they're all mostly just taken from a short story, and they lead to like just a jumping off point for sometimes just a boring action film, like, say, John Woo's Paycheck, perhaps the worst John Woo movie. I really fallen behind on my John Woo movies. I can't say that it was the worst one up to that point when I saw it, though. But it is such a foundational work for cyberpunk as well. And I mean the genre, not the video game series or the recent video game that was made out of the tabletop RPG. Yes, I played the tabletop RPG. I know it was that first, guys. I know. But yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah, I would have to say that of all of Philip K. Dick's stories that were turned into movies, this is definitely in the upper echelon. It's a very low bar. A lot of them are not very good, but it's like this and what Minority Report are pretty good. And
Scanner Darkly, one of his.
Total Recall is my favorite of the Philip K. Dick adaptations.
Oh, yeah, that one
it's just so fun to watch. Not as heady as this. It's a lot trashier, but I kind of enjoy that.
And I like Scanner Darkly all right. It's it's nothing special. It's just guys talking with cartoons drawn over them. But
yes, it was one of the many Mario Paint movies he made. Waking Life, Scanner Darkly, we get it. You use the filter. Well, it wasn't a filter. I know it was a lot of work, but it seems like a lot of work for not a lot of payoff. So let's talk about how it got made into a movie. So there was interest in making an adaptation of this book right around the time it was published, but no one could actually put together a screenplay worth optioning until a little guy named Hampton Fancher came along. What a great name. They don't name him like that anymore, folks. He's got a very long career in TV and movies dating back to the late 50s, though this is one of two notable things he actually wrote. And he was briefly married to the actress who played Lolita in the Kubrick version of Lolita. That's one fun fact about Hampton Fancher. So there you have it.
Interesting. Mm.
And so how does Ridley Scott get involved? This is the project he goes to after trying to get Dune off the ground. The production of Dune is very complicated. And that's another podcast. There should be a Dune podcast. Maybe I will host
Dune
it because later, well, I'll be Dune it
yeah.
very, very soon. Late in life, I'm becoming a real Dune head, and I did not expect that. But yes, he is making Dune. It's not working. He needs something to work on because I believe his older brother passes away. He needs something to get his mind off of what's happening in his life. And this is when he steps into the project, and they need a better title. They're not going to release a movie with the name Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in theaters. It would be an even bigger failure than Blade Runner was. So there was a screenplay of the Alan E. Norse novel called The Blade Runner. So there was an existing book called The Blade Runner, and it was the screenplay was written by William S. Burroughs, and Hampton Fancher, one of the writers of the movie Blade Runner, had a copy of his own. And he's like, oh, this would be a great title for our movie, because they couldn't really figure out a title for the movie Blade Runner. They had things like Android, Mechanismo, and Dangerous Days. And Dangerous Days would later be the very long Blade Runner documentary, but it's such a convoluted thing in that there is a book, there's a sci-fi book called Blade Runner. Someone wrote a screenplay to turn that into a movie. That was never produced, but the name Blade Runner was purchased to use on a the movie version of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? So you can go out and buy the book The Blade Runner, and you're not going to hear about Deckard or androids or anything like that. It's going to be a book about a far-off future in which only a select few can afford medical treatment. It's weird. I don't buy it at all.
Ridiculous.
That's interesting, because I was when I watched the movie and then it was just like you're like I'm a Blade Runner or you're a Blade Runner. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'm sure that will make sense at some point. And then he never runs on any blades or does anything that remotely like could it justify that name. I guess it's meant to be like living on the edge kind of thing,
it's
like
symbolic.
On the edge of life, maybe. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think in the book,
it just
the Blade Runner,
robots around.
It should be called Robot Chaser.
Yeah, exactly.
In the book, The Blade Runner, from what I understand, I haven't read it, but apparently it's about like smuggling medical supplies. So you are a Blade Runner. You're like smuggling supplies to treat people who don't qualify for treatment in this far off sci-fi world. Again, I don't believe it at all. But hey, it's a book.
The cops in the future are very into symbolism and, you know, wording like oh, he's running on the edge of the blade, like he's, you know, he's doing the most dangerous thing. But they're just a lot smarter than the cops now, who just are like Delta Force One or like the Pound Squad or whatever,
or like the Punisher symbol.
Yeah,
have fun with your naming scheme.
They should be more literate, is what I'm saying. The police.
That is sort of everything.
They should all have to take an intro to lit course at the police academy. Especially that guy who makes sound effects. He needs to learn how to read.
I was going to say, you know, with all of this talk about how the naming came about, suddenly the 80s computer game based on the soundtrack makes a lot more sense. Mm. It's pretty much in line with that scheme.
Yes,
I think it doesn't make that much more sense.
Now, you hear about all of these different versions of movies that could have been, and, you know, I often want to jump into the timeline visiting machine and visit the other timelines just briefly to see. This is a version I want to see. The one that they were working on before Scott got involved, it was going to be directed by Robert Mulligan, who was the director of To Kill a Mockingbird, and Deckard was going to be played by Robert Mitchum.
Whoa.
A guy even grumpier than Harrison Ford, but I think he would have done a better job.
I would have liked the age he would have brought to that, for sure. Like, he's, you know, he would have been, what, in his mid-50s in 82 or so, but he drank so much that he'd have seemed like in his 70s. He would feel like current-day Harrison Ford now.
Definitely. Less plane crashes, though. Those will shave the years off, those plane crashes.
Well, he didn't have the money for planes. He was just, you know, drunk driving everywhere.
That's the way we used to do it. No high flying, just drunk driving. So the production continues from here. They have a script. They have a title. Ridley Scott hires a guy named David Peoples to rewrite Hampton Fancher's script. Fancher was put off by this at first. I don't think the two ever met during production, but Fancher eventually liked Peoples' rewrite, and Fancher would come back to do a bit of rewriting on the script himself. And I read some interviews, like I said earlier, it was Scott's idea to turn this into a detective story, and Fancher hated this, but eventually it grew on him over time, and it sounds like Fancher's idea was much smaller and not about the world surrounding Deckard. It was more about a love story between a human and an android, and he said it was a very small scale in which it could have been performed as a play, almost. So he didn't really have the epic sci-fi scale in mind for the movie Scott wanted to make, but he did like the changes that were made to his script. And of course, Hampton Fancher is one of the two screenwriters on 2049, many, many years later, 35 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, again, that's I think that writer, the second writer, made Peebles. He made the right choice. Like, the world building is the best stuff in this movie. Just living in that world, and I kept reminding myself watching the movie. I was like, put yourself into the brain of the year of somebody in 1982 who's seeing this, and like they've never seen this kind of sci-fi world. Like, they've read it in books, they maybe seen like comics or art on it, to an actual like living version of this world. Like, now you can see the seams in it, or you see like, oh, I've seen it done better since then, but like, the world is just amazing. Like, and when the mystery is so thin, let's luxuriate in the world, let's eat a bunch of noodles at all the stands, let's get in the cars.
Now, we'll talk about this more when we talk about the movie. I think the look of the world is amazing, but it really indicates nothing about the status of the world and how people live in it, other than the fact that they have that one geisha commercial they have to see over and over again. 2049, I will say, it does a much better job of showing you how people exist in the world and what you have to do to live in this place. Well, Deckard's apartment is like the apartment I just got out of.
Well, you know,
I think his kitchen is bigger than mine, or was bigger than mine.
You never had space for a piano in your place.
Oh, that's true. That fat cat.
No, well, hey, though, in 2019, weren't we all seeing the same ad served to us over and over again, auto-playing on things? Like,
yeah, I guess it was Flo from Progressive and not a geisha Coke lady.
That's the Reagan era for you. That's the Reagan guarantee, xenophobia.
You do see the signs that say live off world, and people say things like, oh, if I could afford that, I wouldn't be here. Like, we're in the crappy part of the world where the rest of people have to live and the rich people get to leave the planet, and where their replicant slaves are doing everything for them. But I will agree, 2049 digs more into that world for sure.
Definitely. Actually, I feel like Back to the Future 2 is a much better exploration of a future society than Blade Runner, because you have Doc Brown explaining, like, here is all the things people do now. Here is how they eat. Here is how they watch TV. But I wish Blade Runner got into all of that, because Deckard just seems to have a crappy apartment, and that's basically it. There's real no indication. It's like, how is this different in 2019 compared to 1982, except for you see, Asian characters outside. By that I mean writing, not people.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I don't want to, maybe we don't want to get into this, so feel free to cut me off. But I mean, it's kind of racist, right? That kind of trope of just being like, God, imagine if you had to be in this place, where everyone's, where no one's even speaking English. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty xenophobic.
It's a kind of walled city sort of thing, right? I mean, you see it come up kind of a lot. And I had some problems with this movie in terms of this kind of content, other than just that. But it seems to me like it's just what became or already was a reasonably standard, slightly xenophobic kind of a trope. It doesn't ruin the movie. Obviously, I was about to say it's an old movie. I don't know where the cutoff is for that anymore. But
40 years old is a pretty old movie.
Yeah, it's a little bit kind of like, oh, okay, all right. it's like, wouldn't it be awful if, this was what life was like, if it was like living in like some kind of place where the Asians are. I don't know. I don't have to describe it without myself sounding racist.
I mean, it is
very good at this.
This is an old movie. I mean, Citizen Kane was 40 years old when Blade Runner was new.
Yeah.
And now Blade Runner's 40 years old. And I mean, I don't think Ridley Scott is not an American. And I think an American making this movie would be more of the, Japanese are going to eat us alive kind of school of thought. Here, it's just like generic Asians are dominating us. And I think it's really just because Ridley Scott had filmed a lot of commercials in Hong Kong, and he walked away from that saying, like, this is hell on earth. Like, Hong Kong is the worst place to be. I am a pub-crawling guy from the UK. This is the most alien stuff I've ever seen. He didn't take a minute to, like, analyze those thoughts. He's just like, awful, terrible, you don't want to be there. So
British people are famously welcoming to immigrants, aren't they?
Yeah.
Just like Americans.
We're not founded on colonialism and xenophobia at all.
No.
There's no truth in that.
We're talking about how, just put yourself in the 1982 mindset, when you're sitting down for this. Now, I made this joke on another podcast, but when you watch this movie, it starts off Harrison Ford is eating noodles, like at a Chinese noodle place, or I think the owner's Japanese. Again, the movie's really confused about who's scary, which Asian people are scary. But in 2023, you're like, okay, yeah, I would go out for noodles. Those look yummy. But in 1982, you'd be clutching your pearls and saying, what has happened to America?
Yeah, oh yeah, I mean, God. This was the era where you know, the U.S. was very terrified, I guess, on the business level of the Japanese coming to eat their lunch. And, you know, China was starting to pump out more exports for the U.S. market. So we were getting a lot of those. And yeah, if you go through like old industry magazines, people are freaking out about this. And like, it really comes through here as well, because, you know, that trickles down into the, you know, the general zeitgeist. I know there were a lot of people freaking out in Michigan, even until like when I left in the 2010s, you know, driving around a foreign car, I'm going to key it up or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the late 80s, I experienced some of that where it was a scandal if someone bought a Toyota or whatever. Mm-hmm. So even up until my late teens, I thought like, oh my gosh, you're just going to drive that around? What if people vandalize it? And one family was basically like, we're not getting Nintendo. That's from Japan. We're going to buy Sega. And I don't think I knew then either, but I thought like, well, Nintendo's more fun. Well, what's your problem? But, and then in the end, the joke was on them.
You know, I do think about, yeah, I think back then part, the opening of the movie is supposed to be part of like the culture shock of, wow, look at this. You saw a thing that said it's Los Angeles, but everybody's Asian. And even the most white man you could think of, Harrison Ford, is having to pick up chopsticks and eat noodles with those. And he's like rubs them together even in a way to be like, that's right, these are chopsticks, people. But yeah, it's now, because I think it's supposed to be just seen as a culture shock, but you never have Deckard say like, man, I hate speaking. Then why won't people like, he is not like actively, his grumpiness could be him being like, why would these people speak English? But he never says it. So now when you watch it, it sometimes it can come off as like, yeah, this is how it is in a major city. Like literally, I was a month ago in Los Angeles on a rainy day, and we went to this really cool open food market that had tons of different stations at it. And there was the Japanese station, there was a Korean food station, Chinese, Filipino food, Pinoy, all that. And so it just, we live in that nice future. Now I just view it as a nice future that they're showing us, like, yeah, you have all these food mm-hmm. options, it's great. But yes, I do think the intention was, at the very least, the future is many more, much more diverse, but I don't think they would have said that in a positive way. I do think it's part of the shock. Racist yeah. is a strong word, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't mean to say like they came out pointedly to go, let's stick it to the Asians. Like, that's not what I think they were doing here, but it is just, it's a tropey thing, I think. And if this is where yeah. it was born, I kind of got to note it, but I don't think like it's a malicious thing necessarily. You
it's
know?
It's worth stating and it's worth discussing, and this movie does have a point of view when it comes to that, but I also feel like you could see the xenophobia in the movie, in the content of the movie, also in the casting yeah. of the movie, because I was talking about this with my wife, and I was like, if Asian people, Japanese, Chinese, I'm not sure what the movie is trying to say, if they're really in charge, why do we never meet an Asian person with lines in the movie outside of James Hong? There's no like the boss, like the Tyrell Corporation boss, should be a Japanese guy, right?
Well, Kimiko Hishiroge plays Cambodian lady. Come on, Bob. That's a major character. She says, here's your noodles. Or this guy said, or the other noodle guy translates Edward James Olmos for him.
I see. Well, yeah, I just feel like they were not as committed to the bit to the point where they wanted to actually hire Asian people to communicate the fact that, oh, yeah, they're no longer the immigrant class. They are in charge now. I just feel like that's a little telling to me.
Mm-hmm. American hegemony is dead, but not in casting.
Yeah.
I think it's also telling that today you pick up and play something like Cyberpunk and it's pretty much the same. Like,
yeah,
you know, maybe there's like a shade more nuance, a shade more diverse casting, but they're still doing it.
Well, I mean, there's actual African Americans in Cyberpunk as opposed
yeah,
to this
yeah,
film.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I'll say is, yeah, we don't hear Deckard upset about the state of things. He's not like, yeah, welcome to 2019? Yeah, welcome to 2019, press 1 for English. He's never saying anything like that. But at the same time, I'd like him to have any point of view or any opinion on anything. He's just such a He just shoved forward.
Yeah,
he just shoved forward by the
theatrical. Does the theatrical cut have a voiceover where he's just kind of like, I hate it here. This place sucks.
That's not canon. I'm not judging the movie by that.
I don't remember. It's been so long.
That I've rewatched some of the theatrical cut clips online just to see the comparison, be reminded. Like, I think I'm stealing something Bob said to me off mic, but like, it's like he's doing it under gunpoint. Like, he's like, yeah, that's right. She was made special. Yeah.
Yeah, he said he had to be like drag kicking and screaming to the recordings. He didn't want to do it. I have to say, you know, we'll probably get to this actually. We'll probably get to the movie, so I'll save this for when we get to the movie.
Okay. Yeah, I do want to move on to more production stuff, because the production designer behind the amazing look of this movie and then every future thing to follow is Sid Mead. The French artist Mobius passed on this movie, something that he really regretted. But yeah, Sid Mead defined the look of sci-fi future. He worked with James Cameron on Aliens. So like, this and Aliens is the 1-2 punch of just the dark future. And I mean, the Sid Mead's credits are legendary and almost endless, but he also defined the look of the, I believe they're the AT-ATs in Star Wars, the Walkers. Yeah. George Lucas, I hope he paid the man, but he based the design of the Walkers on some of Sid Mead's designs. And yeah, like, one of the most legendary production designers. Just Google image search his name, and you can just pore over so much of his amazing work. It's so influential.
That's so funny. Mobius said no to this, and then after he says yes to the He-Man movie... Masters of the Universe, he did production work on that. Yeah, and it looks...
That's wild.
If you look up his production art for it, really great looking production art, but I don't know how much they actually used for the movie.
That poor man. So I want to talk about the casting now. We mentioned Harrison Ford. He should be the big draw in this movie, because the previous year he kicked off the Indiana Jones franchise, and the next year he's going to be finishing the Star Wars trilogy. You know, those three great movies. There was never any more content to make us think about those ever again. He was going to be in Return of the Jedi the next year. He's 40 in this. He's worked with all the hottest new directors, even though he's got a pretty late start. But he was not a happy camper on this movie, and that really comes through in his very bored performance. You can tell the directors he likes to work with, because he does not play ball with people that rub him the wrong way, I feel, Harrison Ford. And I normally like seeing him in movies. I mean, like, I'm not even a huge Star Wars fan, but, you know, Han Solo is what I'm there for. I don't care about all the lore and the gleep glops and everything. I just want to hear him saying, this is bullshit, you know. Which is why the future, this is just my own axe to grind, I think the newer Star Wars movies don't work, because there's no guy in it saying, this sucks, I hate all of this, and I hate all of you, I'm leaving.
Well, because he has to become a believer by the end of Return of the Jedi. And I mean, honestly, he's too soft in Return of the Jedi. Like, he's literally at the teddy bear picnic going like, these kids, they're all right. Like, he's... No, I mean... The spirit of Harrison Ford is like a stoned guy who doesn't want to work, is what I feel from him. He's just like,
yeah,
that's...
I mean,
he's...
I don't...
best at playing.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm not sure if anyone else read any production stories about Harrison Ford on this movie. At a certain point, he was not talking to Ridley Scott. He was not getting along with other actors on the set, like Sean Young. Sean Young was like very fresh to acting in general, and she was being asked to play this character with a lot more history than she had personally. And apparently Harrison Ford didn't talk to her at all outside of their scenes together. And I also think that like Ridley Scott kept her separate from the other actors to maintain her, you know, alienated kind of status, you know, like slightly off, where she never really had a connection with another person. So she didn't have a great time on this set. And what I heard from interviews reading about Harrison Ford, what people are saying about him is like, he is so smart, he has no patience for anyone. Like, if you waste his time, or if you're a dummy, he is incredibly rude to you. So I think, like, he felt like Ridley Scott was wasting his time, and they had a really rough time together on the set. And I think, I'm pretty sure he didn't want to do the sequel if Ridley Scott was involved. I'm pretty sure they patched things up by now, but whenever I read a Harrison Ford interview on Blade Runner, he goes back and forth on everything so much with this movie.
Yeah, I think he has a complicated thing with it, but I do... that he came back for 2049 eventually shows. I mean, also, he seems ready to take money to do it too. Like, he does things for money, but I'm not. But I mean, I think
Callista needs to eat.
Yeah, he's got to.
Planes aren't cheap.
Yeah, no, you crash planes. What else? His cheapest habit is probably just being a big stoner. But yeah, I think he's. I think he takes, you know, he does take some pride in stuff. I base this, too, of seeing, like, before the new Indiana Jones movie came out, he was doing interviews talking, like, he was literally in tears excited about it. Like, he's like, he, at D23, when they presented the first trailer, he's like, this is a good one. This is a good one. His way of saying he thought it would turn out better than Crystal Skull, which, personally, I don't agree with.
Well, I mean, has he seen it? It sucks. It's awful. I can't believe that he. It's such a shame for him. I feel so bad for him.
But he got paid, and that's what Harrison Ford really cares about. Maybe he was tearing up because he was so excited about that.
Yeah, he's like, it's that whole "they drove a dumb truck full of money to my house" thing.
You know, I like the fact that Indiana Jones gets him teared up, but I also miss when Harrison Ford would be interviewed by website folks. And they'd be like, we're right here. We're here with Harrison Ford, Han Solo himself. Now, Harrison, we got to ask you, is he going to be wearing the same belt he was wearing in Return of the Jedi? And he would just say, I don't fucking know. Or something like that. Yeah, just like he would just swat a nerd question to the ground.
But I think that he did with Conan recently. I watched that went around. That was quite fun.
But eventually, I think he knew, like, this is the bit I do. I'm, like, the lovable grouch, but I think he also doesn't care about the Star Wars lore or anything like that. He's just like, it's just a job that keeps earning me millions of dollars.
Conan can talk him into the bits. I think Mark Hamill, find a Mark Hamill anytime he's imitated him in the last, like, 30 years. Like, Mark Hamill knows Harrison Ford very well, and he loves him, but he's also just like, Mark, whatever. Like he's just a grumpy old man. Like, it's
with a heart of gold. And I was looking at who else could have been in this movie, and apparently Ridley Scott was courting Dustin Hoffman for this role for Deckard, but Dustin Hoffman wanted to change the script too much and add things about cryogenics, and he was just tired of having endless meetings with Dustin Hoffman. So
he turned
to Harrison Ford.
I have heard Dustin Hoffman is more difficult than you would think to work with on stuff.
I'm stuck on this. He wanted to just add stuff about cryogenics. Like, does he just like cryogenics? That's just his shit. He's just going, I don't know, man. What about some cryogenics? There's some frozen shit in here.
Was he investing in it?
I think he might have just read a magazine article before a meeting and said, okay, this is the new angle for Blade Runner.
Actors are weird. When they have their own ideas for stuff, they're like, I want to make this because my idea is this for the movie. Like, and if you're big enough as Dustin Hoffman, you can have that kind of control. Mm.
And let's move on from Harrison Ford to talk about Rutger Hauer as Roy Batty, best character in the movie.
So good.
You know,
best performance too.
Best performance. The second you see him, I just was thinking, I want to do an edit of Blade Runner where the movie just starts with Roy Batty and you only briefly see Harrison Ford, because this is, I mean, 2049 is a much smarter movie because it gets you into the point of view of a replicant and what their life is like. And it explores that kind of how they interact with humanity and all that stuff. Roy Batty's a fascinating character, charismatic, scary, and he definitely has very high stakes and a mission. He's not just wearily going through the motions like Deckard is. And yeah, the tears in the rain speech, it's been said before, but it was completely improvised. It was like written on the set by him. I don't think Ridley Scott really wanted to do it, but he was talked into it. And I think that is the one thing really people take away from this movie. And it wasn't even in the text. It was something he added. Like, this is what this character's point of view is. And I know I told my wife that when I die, I'm going to be holding Louis. I'll say something profound and then I'll let him go. Louis's my parrot, by the way. Just let him go into the air. And because his wings are clipped, he'll just kind of flop to the ground and just walk back to his cage.
He adds, Batty is the soul of the movie. He adds so much to it. To know that he, like, his whole speech at the end is so much just Rutger Hauer improvising it. Like, that adds the fucking point to the movie. Like, he's telling you what matters in this movie. Like, he is, okay, my big brain take on the movie, or one of them is that, and why I like it by the end, is that Deckard sucks. Like, he's a shitty cop, like all cops, but he shoots people in the back. He doesn't, people just tell him, these guys are here, go shoot him. He is always above everybody else. Like, the underdogs in the fights are the unarmed replicants against the guy with, like, a cannon that just fucking blasts them. Like, he sucks. And Roy Batty starts the fight by saying, hey, this isn't very fair. Like, you've got a gun. And he's just toying with him the whole time. And then at the end, meek loser-ass Decker about to fall. And Roy Batty's like, oh, hey, I'm going to save you. You suck. Anyway, I'm dead. Like, he's,
yeah, I mean, that's a character that I want to follow for the whole movie. He's a character with a philosophy, with a strong like moral core, with a point of view. Deckard just is a guy, they just aim him at replicants, he kills them, and then he gets rewarded at the end.
And these are, and they're also like, they're freed slaves. They are, or they are, you know, they're terrorists because they don't want to be slaves. They don't want to be servants. Like, and they're telling him at the, like, again, Batty tells him, you know, hey, this is the fear of being a slave. It's reminding him, like, you're in the same position as me and you're hunting me down, you know, like, it's, yeah, I prefer, this movie without him is not a good movie, or it's
absolutely,
like 30% worse.
Would it be devil's advocacy to say that, they have like superhuman strength and they killed like 30 people or something, that slightly angles me in the sort of, maybe everyone's horrible in this movie, actually, kind of, you know. I mean, Deckard pretty much forces himself on Rachel at one point. It's a really uncomfortable.
Yeah, he's a bad
sequence.
Guy.
I don't know what's
deeply
going
uncomfortable.
On there.
He's a cop. He's a cop. Yeah,
but Batty is way more interesting than him. I totally agree. He's so anime, right? Like,
a Roy Batty character after this movie.
Yeah. Is there any point where he stares at his hand?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Before he pokes the thing through it, he's like, no,
Because I know Kay in the sequel does do some hand staring, some old-fashioned anime hand staring. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's a lot about this movie that I feel it does the messaging and the themes of the book very sloppily, but I feel that Roy Batty, and particularly like the last 20 minutes of the movie or 30 minutes when he's the focus, is where it does the best job of carrying that forward. You know, his whole interactions with the Tyrell, head of the company, and like he's desperate, and he's not desperate for himself. He's desperate for himself. He's also desperate for like this other replicant who he cares about, and like he's showing this level of emotional maturity and empathy that ostensibly replicants do not have, but. You know, Rutger Hauer is bringing that through very effectively, more effectively than anyone else in this film.
I think that's why I came away from the movie feeling kind of positive about it, because, I mean, the first half, I was a little bit kind of like, is this Blade Runner? And then it ends, I think, in really strong, really well, and it's entirely him. I mean, you know, thinking about it, the sequence where he kills, I can't remember the character's name, you know, his creator,
Tyrell.
Essentially. Yeah, that's something else. Like, that's crazy to think about. And that's awesomely violent as well. Not to be that kind of caveman, but my God, that's fierce. But to even just think about it, of him just like breaking down as he destroys his own creator's like brain, it's really something else. And then it goes off from there, just completely like off the rails in a great way.
You mentioned, Stuart, that everyone in this movie is kind of bad and the replicants do kill a lot of people while escaping. I think the fact that Scott doesn't show you them killing people for the most part makes the intent feels like you're supposed to sympathize with them more than Deckard. But that just makes me want to watch them more. And in fact, they kill Sebastian, their real creator, off screen. You just hear like, oh, he's dead. Go to his apartment and go check it out. So I think if they wanted you to just say, well, I'm done with Batty, they would show him killing a sweet little Gomer Pyle creator.
That's true. That is a real cheap out of like, he has to be dead for plot purposes, but they won't show you it. That they just do it in voiceover. It's easy to just go like, hey, whatever happened to Sebastian in this movie?
It's not important.
They do turn it around. He is so much more charismatic than Deckard is, and his desperation, like his fear, and his in the end, the kind of acceptance of it, just kind of, it really does come through. It's the most effective thing in the movie, and it is genuinely emotional, I think. you come away from the movie having earned this emotion, and it's all been done in the last like 15 minutes almost, and it's all on that performance. It's absolutely something else.
Absolutely.
Batty is the morally superior character. Like, he fixes his hand so he can save Decker, while Decker would have just shot him in the face if he still had his gun in that moment. Like, Deckard wouldn't have saved Batty. Batty saves Deckard.
Yeah.
So let's move on to other actors. Of course, I mentioned Sean Young, just getting her career off really in the early 80s. I think she was in Stripes before this. The part of Stripes that's not, basic training, which no one remembers, I think she's in that.
I love this cast, by the way. I think it's a great cast.
She's great. I think she was just, they were just very cruel to her on the set, like especially Ridley Scott. It felt like sort of like a Kubrick and Shelley Duvall kind of thing, where she was made to do take after take. In the oral history I was reading, I believe the line is like, when we first meet her, she's like, "Do you like our owl?" And she had to say that like 30 times because Ridley Scott wanted her to say owl as one syllable. And just she had to get it right. So I think she was just beaten into submission by doing take after take after take. She was a new actor, and I think that she was taken advantage of because of that on a set with a lot of veterans like Scott, like Harrison Ford, and so on.
Hollywood was rough to Sean Young in general.
Yeah.
Hollywood was rough to women in general, I think. This movie's pretty rough on women in general.
I was going to say, especially Sean Young, because like her status in a little bit after this movie was like, oh, that crazy lady. Yeah. But she never stopped working, but she had a real fall from grace and had like just this bad perception. But then you have to look at those stories of like, oh, this insane female actor, so hard to work with. You have to wonder like, what's coloring that perspective? Yeah, you know,
she's hard to work with. Not Harrison Ford, who won't talk to the director and won't fucking listen to anyone. He keeps getting worse.
No, he's a man who knows what he wants.
Yeah. Cool guy.
My understanding, and I, this is secondhand, someone told me this, but someone who is knowledgeable, so if I'm wrong, feel free to strike it from the record, is that sequence where Deckard does sort of force himself on her, that was basically just like, don't tell her what you're going to do, just be aggressive, just go, like. And the reaction is like, I mean, it's not really acted, you know, it's thrown kind of into a wall. It's horrible.
Yeah, you're correct about that, Stuart. Like, I was reading. I'm not sure if it was if Sean Young was giving the quote or whatever, or maybe somebody on the set or the writer. But they were saying, yeah, that was not scripted. And it did. She was a little hurt by it physically, and she did like actually cry because of her pain and her shock at like what Harrison Ford was doing to her in that scene.
There are so many stories out of Hollywood that are like that, that are just like, oh, we couldn't get the thing we want, so we just did it for real, ha 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 ha. You know, funny joke, like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We couldn't get her to do what we want, so I just literally cut her with this razor, ha ha ha. And then years later, when everyone gets over themselves, they're just like, wait a minute, what? That's insane. What are you talking about? Well, that's not funny. That's not like a bit. That's abuse.
Well, there was.
Oh, sorry, I'm getting on my nose.
There was this old feeling in movie making, and this was wrong, but that like it came from Alfred Hitchcock before that too, of just like the director's job is to get the art made, and by, you know, and if you got to like slap a if you have to slap an actor to be ready for the scene, or if you have to like risk the lives of the guy holding the camera, even like if you got to do all those things, it's worth it for the pure art of cinema. Like that was how it was presented, and yeah, it's that is wrong, but that's why everybody talked about it back then, and it was it was condoned on sets because they're like, well, yeah, we're all agreeing this is how you make good movies. It's the same with video games where they say, well, there has to be crunch. I've never made a good game without crunch. It's just how it is.
Right.
Like,
yeah, it was sadly common. She's I think she's doing okay now. But she had a rough time in Hollywood after this. We can move on just to name a few other actors. This is actually a fairly small cast in this movie. So Daryl Hannah as Pris, she is basically the Harley Quinn to Roy Batty's Joker.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because that was the first vibe I got. Holy shit, it's Harley Quinn.
William Sanderson as J.F. Sebastian. I love him. They'll use him later on Batman the Animated Series as the scientist who makes Hardak, but
I love his. I just like making robots. They're so much fun.
I like his very. It's a voice you don't expect to hear in the future. I don't know why. I'm not saying Southerners are extinct in the future.
It kind of made me think it's like Ernest goes to like 2099 or whatever. It's now, like super.
William Sanderson is one of the greatest character actors of his generation who doesn't get enough. I love him so much. He. At the time, or right after this, he was cast on many seasons of the Bob Newhart show. Newhart. And he was great as the man with his Daryl and his other brother Daryl. But if you really want to appreciate his acting ability, watch every episode of Deadwood because his character in Deadwood has to basically give Shakespearean level like monologues in it with that same accent. And he's such like a cowardly little backstabber in it. And he's so, he is so damn good in Deadwood. But because he's a little guy with a Southern accent, you know, everybody underestimates his acting ability, but he's Deadwood gave him the greatest platform of his acting.
Oh, I was going to say, we covered the episode His Silicon Soul on our Batman the Animated Series podcast, Henry, on the Talking Simpsons Patreon, and he recently passed away, and that's when I learned a lot about him.
He's great. He was great, yeah. And also, Emmett Walsh is another of my favorite, like, guys you see and everything.
I was gonna say, it's kind of shocking to see him, because Emmett Walsh is the last guy I expect to see in a cyberpunk future, the last guy to survive that long. But hey, the actual Emmett Walsh lived beyond 2019, so he could have made it to the actual Blade Runner times if things shook out that way for our reality.
And speaking of guys who, like, at least he lived long enough to get his flower, and he's still alive, James Hong, like, he, you know, thanks to him being in Everything Everywhere All at Once, that was getting him a lot of, like, Oscar buzz and award buzz, and people were finally like, hey, this guy is awesome, isn't he? Like, let's give him the Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame.
He knew the kind of role he was expected to play, and he did a really good job. In fact, he plays like a kind of a kooky doctor in Blade Runner. That's what I'll call the role, like a kooky, eccentric doctor.
That's about right, yeah.
And then I just saw a theatrical screening of Tank Girl the other day, and he is the exact same role. He gives the villain like a cybernetic arm, but it's the exact same character, basically. Like, he just be the kooky scientist we want you to be, James Hong.
Well, if you were in this movie, this could be your job for the rest of your life, of being cast of like by people who loved Blade Runner. Like, could you sort of do that thing in my movie and do the more Blade Runner stuff in my movie?
So we're done with talking about actors. Of course, the score is superb. It's done by Vangelis, which I thought was the name of a group, but actually just some Greek guy with a name that's not as marketable as Vangelis. And,
he passed away last year, this year, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Tremendous composer. He did Chariots of Fire. He did Conquest of Paradise. But this was the best thing he ever did, I think.
Yeah, he just came off of winning the Oscar for Chariots of Fire, doing the soundtrack of that. And the weirdest thing is, the most tragic thing is, this movie did not get an official soundtrack until the director's cut came out in 1992.
Absolutely.
There were like little places you could find some of the music. Like, there was an orchestral performance of some Blade Runner songs on another CD, but not until the director's cut came out in 1992 would you actually get the full soundtrack.
If you had the terrible game based on the soundtrack.
Yes,
you could hear 2 minutes of absolute dog shit sequencing that sounded nothing like it at the beginning. That was unskippable.
I guess that was
you don't like ZX Spectrum renditions of really cool like.
As the biggest ZX Spectrum fan on Retronauts and possibly the world, no, it's horrible. Even the C64 one isn't good, and that's usually pretty all right.
Well, you know, the problem with the C64 version is that it just keeps playing over and over through the entire game, and it doesn't play the whole song. It just keeps resetting every time you change a screen, and so you get really used to that first 30 seconds, and then it just keeps happening.
I keep cracking up at just the idea of just the audacity of just like, yeah, it's based on the score, mate. It's not based on the game at all. Wink, wink.
Yeah, my my notes, I just wrote in the music rules, though, because, you know, the music, it's not... So the visual design, I think you can point to a million things and say, okay, yes, this was pulled directly from Blade Runner. People really loved this. You don't get that quite as much with the music, but I feel like anything that has to do with a cyberpunk setting is just looking straight at what Vangelis did with this soundtrack. It's really good, and it's really iconic.
Yeah, and they do a pretty good job of aping Vangelis in 2049 with Hans Zimmer and his associates. They do a pretty good job. But, I mean, it all starts here with this iconic soundtrack. But let's talk about the failure of the movie. So, made for $30 million, this movie pulled in $42 million. So they technically didn't lose money, but I have to assume if they made any profit, it was very tidy because the additional $12 million profit, a lot of it went to promotions. This is not what you would expect for what they were assuming would be the next Star Wars, the next big Harrison Ford vehicle. But here's the real problem. The movie released on June 25th, 1982, just 2 weeks after a little guy named E.T. strolled his way into theaters and won our hearts. So that would go on to become, at the time, the highest grossing movie of all time. And nothing in its path was safe. E.T. destroyed all it touched, and Blade Runner was one of the unfortunate victims. I think The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, was another movie that suffered because of E.T., another great 82 movie.
E.T. So, was not good in 82. Holy shit.
E.T. soaked up all the impressions. Like, yeah, poor Harrison Ford stabbed in the back by his Indiana Jones' father, Steven Spielberg. Like, Spielberg giveth and taketh away in Harrison Ford's life.
Yeah, filmgoers were like, I don't want to see the dark future. I want to see the small, wet alien who eats candy and, you know, warms my heart. But yeah, I mean, go back to our E.T. episode. It's easy to forget just how big E.T. was. Again, it was, at a certain point in time, the highest grossing movie of all time. And it held that record, I think, for at least 9 or 10 years before it might have been Jurassic Park. It might have been The Lion King. It was something around that era.
I believe it was Jurassic Park. If I'm basing this entirely on, as a Star Wars nerd, the tit for tat of Lucas and Spielberg both commissioning congratulatory artwork of like R2-D2 high-fiving E.T. to say like, well, you surpassed us. And then it started when Jaws got beat by Star Wars, and it was like Jaws and Steven Spielberg congratulate Star Wars on being number one. Then E.T. passed them, and R2-D2's like, congratulations, E.T., you beat us. Then it was Jurassic Park, and then Special Edition surpassed that, and then Titanic. And
yeah, James Cameron comes along and he's just like, screw all y'all.
I don't know if that tradition still
I got a big boat.
I don't know if that tradition has still stayed alive with Avatar 3, which I think is...
Yeah, there has been the whole kind of congratulations Avengers Endgame, you know, being the highest grossing of all time. And then, that has still been happening, I think. No, God knows why they bother.
No commissioned art for Howard the Duck surpassing anything.
No, in fact, it's still losing money somehow. Nobody can figure it out. Огненный минерал, шедевр Леонардо да Винчи, пряные растения, непроглядные ночные тьма, один драгоценный камень красного цвета, необитаемая далекая страна, очень далекая страна. So I do want to go over the various versions of this movie. So because of its status as a high-profile failure that really appealed to nerds like us, Blade Runner became a cult film. It was constantly under renovation to the point where there's a distinct Wikipedia article about the many, many different versions of the film. But thankfully, Ridley Scott put his finishing touches on the movie for the 25th anniversary in 2007, which is the easiest version to watch now. It's if you pull it up on Amazon, you're going to get the final cut. Mm. I don't know what other marketplaces offer anything else. But I want to go over the various editions, at least the ones with significant differences. So there is, number one, the work prints, which normally isn't counted. Work prints normally aren't counted as a version of a movie, but this was later made available to the public in a 5-disc Ultimate Edition in 2007. So audience reaction to this is what caused the changes for the theatrical version, but then later audience reactions to this is what caused the director's cut in 1992 to happen. So we'll get to it, but this work print was later screened outside of the test market context, and people loved it. And this is what inspired Ridley Scott and Warner Brothers to make a better version of Blade Runner for release. So there's the work print. And now we have the theatrical version, which is now actually pretty hard to find. I'm sure you can easily... They made a zillion of these DVDs back in the day. It'd be easy to pick one up at a used DVD store or whatever. But this includes the added voiceover, which we mentioned before, and a happy ending where Deckard and Rachel ride off into the sunset. And despite how laughable the narration sounds, Ford has said in recent interviews, I was actually trying. They were giving me no direction. I was trying as hard as I could. And here's the thing that surprised me. The original version of the movie that they intended to shoot had narration, but Scott decided to take it out. So the narration you hear in the theatrical version is narration created after the fact, trying to summon the same energy as the original narration that was cut out in the first place. So it's very convoluted, but you can pull these clips up on YouTube. They don't offer you any information you actually need, and it just sounds like Harrison Ford is basically, it's Krusty in the booth doing the lines for the talking Krusty doll.
I mean, the narration
is... Learn from professional kid.
The narration isn't good, but I mean, yeah, I'm not that... fits that they at one point did want narration and it wasn't just the studio saying it, because if you're going to try to ape, you know, Maltese Falcon or whatever, you do need narration from your hard-boiled detective. Like, it makes a certain sense, even though it doesn't work entirely in the version we saw.
I went after because I watched the final cut, and I went back and looked at the happy ending, because I was like, what on earth could it possibly be? Because the ending of the final cut doesn't seem that unambiguous. It doesn't seem that unhappy. It's him choosing freedom, you know? But then I went and watched it, and it's just like, oh, they've just gone on holiday.
They've just gone on holiday.
What the fuck am I looking at? Like, it's like a car commercial. Why are they here now? How did they get there? What's going on? This is absurd.
It actually reminds me a bit of the movie Brazil, made around the same time, about a similar dark future. It's actually a movie I'd much rather watch than Blade Runner. I'm sorry, folks. Not as influential, but I think much better. But it was as mangled by the studio and given a really bad ending, and then later made available with the ending the director intended.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, with Brazil, that was, I think, perhaps... Gilliam learned from also a famously very nice director to his actors, a great guy, but Brazil is a brilliant film. And I think he learned from stuff like Blade Runner happening a couple years beforehand that, he got out in the press for it. Like, he fought to keep it the same. He took the work print from the distributors. Like, he, you know, at the time, Robert De Niro had some mystery to him and wasn't just sad old man that we see now, but he never did interviews. He's like, oh, I'll do an interview. And then he just sat still while Terry Gilliam talked on the news about, like, they're trying to steal my movie from me. Like, he went to the press to fight it and was able to keep the Love Conquers All ending that's on the Criterion is almost like a joke that they included.
It's so bad.
It's so sarcastic because they clearly are Mickey under duress. So, go ahead,
Stuart. I think it's the perfect comparison, because that's how I felt watching the air quotes happy ending for Blade Runner. It's bollocks. Like, what? It has no basis. It comes from nowhere and has no meaning, and it's completely just drivel. Like, I'm angry about it.
It's just there.
The ambiguous ending is better, and then 2049 is basically answering the question, what happened next? Kevin.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's funny to hear that this originally had voiceover that they took out and then slapped new voiceover back in, because I feel like there's a lot of things about this world and setting that could have used a voiceover to explain, like you mentioned earlier, how people live in this world. Everyone talks about how rare animals are and all this stuff, but there's no real explanation for, like, the eco side and environmental damage that's going on. That could have used a voiceover.
You're totally right, Kevin. We hear a few world-building details about, you know, how when they're asking Rachel when the Void Comtesse is happening, like, someone buys you a calfskin wallet, what do you do? And she's like, I report them to the authorities. So we learn that animals are very rare, if leather is illegal. But I'll go back to my previous comparison because I think it's a good one. Back to the Future 2, again, explains more about the world. We learn more about how these flying cars work and interact with the world and the issues involved with them. Here it's just like, yeah, flying cars, big whoop. They're going to land, they're going to fly, you get it.
Yeah, in the book, like, they pull those responses and questions from the Void Kampf test, like, directly from the book. But in the book, you have the context because they just tell you straight up, oh, there's been an environmental disaster. Most things have died. Most people have left the planet. The people who are left are, like, kind of depressed and, like, trying to find a meaning where they can. And there's a whole new religion around it. And animals are extremely rare. And anyone who, like, torments or kills an animal, that's like a class one felony.
Maybe there's a happy medium, you know. I'm probably not a popular opinion, but maybe there is a happy medium. Maybe there's one more cut to be done.
The explanatory cut.
Yeah.
Going back to that that thing we're talking about, Kevin, about the animals. It's funny because there's that fact from the book that's kind of echoed in some dialogue, but then because Ridley Scott wants to portray like the scary Asian wet market, there's just live animals all over the place on the streets, right? Like chickens and like bison or whatever. I forget.
Ostriches.
That's true. Yeah. I forgot. There's tons of. Well, perhaps those are the synthetic animals, like the fake snake that that Zora dances with. Perhaps
could be. So we're going to move on to the next version. I think we're on number three now. So we have the 1992 director's cut. The story behind that, I'm just going to give it very broad strokes here. Somebody found a 70mm work print for Blade Runner. They screened it once with permission of Warner Brothers. It was a huge hit. They started screening it in different cities. Scott found out and was like, well, this version is rough and unfinished. Let me step in and do a director's cut on by myself, and then this will be fine to release. Unfortunately, he's too busy with Thelma and Louise, another really good movie, better than Blade Runner, I dare say, to actually have full control over the director's cut. That will come much later, but this he is overseeing, and this is what's changed about Blade Runner. So he removed the voiceovers, and he inserts a dream sequence in the film, which is basically footage taken from his movie Legend. So, go ahead, Stuart. Sorry.
I'm sorry because I feel like I'm butting in, not really knowing. But I read that they actually did shoot that for Blade Runner. It's not from Legend. For some reason, that's been spread around, but it was shot for Blade Runner. Not that it actually matters. I don't know why I felt the need to come in on that one.
I know Legend. That's the case. I know Legend came after. I don't know if they shot the footage knowing he would later use it for Blade Runner, but I think Legend is 85 and this is 82. Yeah, so the dream sequence is inserted. It will be expanded in a later version, but then we have the happy ending. And then we have Scott adding something that I don't like, and I think the sequel disagrees with entirely, and I think the screenwriters are on board with disagreeing with this. He adds a giant clue at the end that highly suggests that Deckard himself could be a replicant. And I feel like the text of the film supports this in no way. The screenwriters really build in no details to support this this thesis or suggest this for the character of Deckard. It's hotly debated. But then in a very recent interview, Ridley Scott said, oh, yeah, that was just something I put in as a sequel hook. So I don't think he was thinking about it too much either. But I don't like this. I really don't like this choice. And again, it was made with, I mean, Ridley Scott, this is his vision. This is Blade Runner is his movie, but the screenwriters did not sign off on this this change to the film.
Well, so that implication is that because he has the vision of the unicorn, and they already talk about how Rachel is such an advanced machine that she has implanted memories to make her think that she is not a replicant, that implies that there could be others like that. If Deckard was that, then his dream of a unicorn would be an implanted memory, and Gaff, Edward James Olmos' character, who seems to know everything, him presenting him with a leaving behind an origami unicorn means he knows Deckard has the visions, just as Deckard explains the Rachel's visions, like, oh, you have these memories, I know all your memories because I know it was implanted. Then Gaff must know that the unicorn memories are implanted into Deckard, and that's why he leaves behind the origami to say, I know you're a replicant because I know your dreams.
See, that's interesting, Henry, because I by the end of it, I thought it was honestly not really that ambiguous that he was. Like, that he realizes it and he fucks off. Like, that seemed to be the ending of the movie to me. There's so much that hints on it, like... you know, when Rachel says to him, did you ever take that test yourself? And he just completely, like, doesn't respond and goes and has a little breakdown in his stupid apartment. And to me, by the end, the decision of him going like, okay, yeah, I'm out of here, fuck this, that felt so much to me like just, yeah, he's realized that he's only got so much time, he's going to spend it with this person, you know. But then again, maybe... whatever, I don't know. It's not completely unambiguous, I suppose, but that's what it read to me as a first-time viewer.
Yeah, I think the screenwriters wanted to leave it very slightly ambiguous, because in their script they have Rachel asking Decker, did you ever take the test, you know. But to me it doesn't work, and then in the sequel doesn't bear that out at all. He's clearly, I mean,
yeah,
unless,
the fact he's still there is, yeah, a pretty big, like, yeah.
And he looks like a 74-year-old Harrison Ford. He's not like pristine.
I need to rewatch that sequel, but at the start, doesn't Batista say, the wrestler and actor David
Batista?
No,
it's Drax. It's Drax. Yeah, it's,
but, and he's great in the movie, by the way, but he says that, like, oh yeah, Deckard and Rachel, like, they're famous to replicants because they were special ones who actually get to live longer. I thought, but again, I haven't seen the movie since it was in theater, so I could be misremembering. But
yeah, I mean, I know Rachel is one that can live longer, which is why when we hear Gaff's dialogue over the end shot, it doesn't make any sense. I think they forgot that, oh yeah, because it's like, enjoy your time left, however long that will be, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh no, Rachel is one of the long-living androids. But yeah, to me, the movie, I don't want to give away too much about the movie, but to me, he seemed human. Again, this is like hotly debated. I think there's no definitive answer on either side, and people feel very strongly about it, which is interesting, because to me, it just was like matter of fact, like, no, human. He was like, I killed four replicants. I can have sex with one of them. I'm leaving with her. Goodbye.
I've always got to say I'm on the other side of that. I think he is a replicant. I think Batty's speech at the end of him, he's like, now you feel the fear of a slave. Like, that's him saying, like, you are like me. Do you not get this? You're killing yourself here by killing me. You're hunting us down. Maybe I'm making the leaps to make it a better movie, but it makes Deckard's struggle much more interesting. Is if he's a replicant who thinks he is a human, who's killing other replicants and keeping them in their place, like, that makes him a more tragic figure.
To me, it was much more matter-of-fact, which is what I feel like the whole movie is very matter-of-fact. And, I mean, again, this isn't something that has not been decided. It's up to interpretation, but I feel like... when Batty saves him, it's like, you have finally know what it feels like to be hunted. You're now on the other side. To me, it was that simple. It's like, I put you in my shoes, and you finally understand what it's like to essentially be like a slave hunter. Mm-hmm. And after that, that's when he has the change of heart. Like, I can't do this anymore. I finally have empathy now because I was put in the other person's perspective. It was that straightforward to me. Anyways, watching the movie.
I'm with Bob on this one. I agree that I don't think the movie bears out very well that Deckard's a replicant. And it's funny because they do briefly, there's like a two chapter sequence in the book where it's like a replicant's like, you're one of us, you're also an android, and Deckard's like, oh no, really, I've got implanted memories and everything. And then like, he learns, oh, this is just a trick, they're just trying to mess with me, no, I'm fine. I'm gonna
bullied.
Pass the test real quick. And then we're going to have another, like, 10 chapters.
Quick flight camp and just get back to work. Let's just go.
Yeah.
Bash that out.
But ultimately, like, it doesn't really matter that much one way or the other in either format of the story. Because, like, it's about, like, okay, are you able to empathize with these androids and their struggle? Great. Super. How do you deal with that? In the movie, fucks off on a holiday.
Yeah, you go fucks off on a holiday, yeah.
The mystery and the ambiguity is part of why, though, the popularity has sustained for so long.
Oh, yeah,
I do think
for
that,
sure,
like, that,
definitely.
That
yeah.
question is why people, because, and then every new release of it was, well, they add a thing that confirms my vision of what I think Deckard is in the movie.
It's, I mean, that's how you get your movie. That's how you make a cult classic. You don't explain adequately information in the movie.
That's how you sell new DVDs.
Like Donnie Darko. You need the Donnie Darko strategy guide to figure out what Donnie Darko's about.
And then you see the director's cut where they explain everything, and you're like, oh, it was bullshit. It's just complete drivel. It's astonishing how bad that is. If we ever do a Donnie Darko episode, my God.
And then, so we have one final version. This is it for Blade Runner, the one you'll see on Amazon Prime or wherever you buy this and rent it. It's the final cut, 2007. Ridley Scott oversaw the entire process. This version incorporates a lot of changes from different versions, like international versions. It retains all of the violence that he wanted originally. The unicorn dream sequence is expanded, but I think ultimately it's like 42 seconds or something like that. Yeah. And that is basically his vision finally came true, I guess 25 years after the original movie. That was in theaters, apparently. Henry, you did see it in Berkeley when you first moved there?
It had a limited release, It had a limited release. I saw it in theaters because it felt so special. Now, they do make special edition style changes of, like, you know, how, oh, this should have had, like, 10 X-Wings instead of 4 X-Wings in the trench run, like that kind of thing. Like, for example, in the famous dove releasing scene, that they completely change the exterior of the building it flies by. The coloring is completely different. Hmm. Like, and I watched a couple side-by-side comparison videos just to be reminded of that. And I think if you're a purist, you're like, no, it should look like 1982 special effects. You shouldn't have 2007 era special effects and digital replacement. I think it's subtle enough that it doesn't feel like you're looking at a CGI Jabba the Hutt walking around. It's not as insulting, but it's not pure. I would say director's cut is closer to pure than final cut is.
Now, I want to mention special effects because we talked about Sid Mead, and I feel like we are just, everything is a special effect now, and we are just kind of just so immersed in them, nothing really stands out. Because when you would get to a special effect scene in a movie like this, you're like, that's a special effect, I'm looking at one. And it's interesting to see, I mean, this gorgeous movie, great motion control camera work, miniature work, matte paintings, all the great stuff you would see in movies before everything was CGI. Yes, I'm an old man, but I did notice when I watched 2049 is, like, in the year 2017, this perspective is, you've seen it all. We don't need to show you vistas or cityscapes that often. You are so spoiled, this will have no effect on you. So they really don't. They're really not luxuriating in that, like Blade Runner 82 was, where it's like, look at what we built. You've never seen this before. You've never seen this kind of special effect, this kind of optical effect. I feel like you can definitely see the two time periods in which these films were made and how inured to special effects that we are today.
What 2049 instead dives into more is like, we can do lighting. So, like, look at the lighting on everything is a color.
Everyone is a streamer in that movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Here's Jared Leto.
Yeah. Hey, oh, he's great. If I'm casting a slimy guy to own a company, like, you know, you could do worse than Jared Leto. I wouldn't cast him in things, obviously. But if you're going to cast somebody to be a slimy rich guy.
You know, if he's got to be typecast for something, let it be something that he actually is.
Yeah, I just assume that they just turn the cameras on in his home and he's like, oh, we're making a movie?
This is about how I'm a great guy? Yeah, okay, yeah.
Just say the stuff you would normally say, Joe.
If we want to talk about special effects, I mean, it's because I was born in 1982. I just love seeing the craft of these. And obviously, a lot of work goes into CGI effects. People are like less respected now, and, you know, their jobs are less steady now than they were back then. But I do appreciate the craft that does not simply exist today. Like seeing the paintings, all of that stuff. It's hard to talk about it because it's all visual, very visual, but it is just a treat because there is an expiration date on when movies stop looking like this.
I think
that would be I'm going to say 2004. I'm going to hard limit there. Listeners.
I think after Jurassic Park Lost World, that's when people were like, oh, okay, you can just replace digitally replace a million things. Well, also, I think we need to adapt into having fluorescent lights attached to umbrellas. That's what we should be doing in current day.
You can go out in the rain and then go back into the rave.
Yes, yeah. I do want to say it's funny that how I think the director's cut is the first example of it. H Bomber Guy, the YouTuber, has a really good video on the history of director's cuts and how they're presented and marketed. But yeah. Warner Brothers in particular, they profit more than anybody off of their fuck ups, like, because they get all of this press of like, oh, you'll never see the Richard Donner version of Superman 2. You'll never see the director's cut of Blade Runner. You'll never see all these different versions of movies. And then they're like, well, we'll sell it to you. We'll sell it again. They just did it very profitably for the Snyder cut. And I'm sure they're going to do it with many more films. There's going to be one for Suicide Squad. The Suicide Squad is, of course, Suicide Squad 2.
Well, whatever movies they're not dumping the negatives in acid, they will resell to you.
Yeah. Why are they making director's cuts of all these shitty movies?
Because fucking people buy them, man.
I don't get it.
The hogs like the slop.
I watched the Snyder Cut, and yeah, okay, the Snyder Cut was better than the Joss Whedon one, but we're talking like 2 stars to 1 star, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to watch more of Suicide Squad. Fucking hell.
Zack Snyder fans got deep pockets.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah,
they really do.
All sorts of deep things.
Now, we're running out of time really shortly here, but I do want to... So we talked so much about the movie. So, again, my issue with the film is that I love detective stories. I love mystery stories. There's no real mystery. And the one main bit of investigation that Deckard does is to kill a character that's not really well-defined, and it's the Dancer. And I think the one scene that Scott should have cut out is when Deckard goes what I call undercover gay... and sneaks into the dressing room like, oh, sweetie, I have got to see your dressing room. It is a choice he's making, and I think someone should have talked to him on the set that day, but it is embarrassing.
I had fun watching it. It's not good. No, it's bad, him going undercover like that. Also, it's like, he's undercover. He doesn't even, like, wear a different hat. He's just like,
exactly.
Yeah.
He's a shitty detective. He's just like, yes, because I changed my voice, I'm suddenly a different person. And, yeah, I mean, again, the issue I have is, like, that's part of the investigation he does. That's, like, the fun stuff I like to see, but it's so straightforward. And then after he kills that character, he runs into the other replicant in the street. That character is then dead. And then his boss is like, go to that building. In the movie, it's almost over,
and
then the movie's
over.
He
doesn't even kill that guy. Somebody else has to kill him him.
Rachel kills him. Yeah. So, I mean... That's just my main issue with the movie story-wise. And, I mean, I think Ford said something else besides the detecting thing. I think he's like, oh, it's all design. It's all artifice. And none of it is, like, substance. And I do feel that way about this movie. And, again, not to repeat myself too much, but I feel like 2049, it has so much respect for the movie. I'm sure everyone who made it loves the original movie. But it's saying something. There's a point of view. It's not just the production design. And it's the point of view that I wanted this movie to have.
I'm on the other side of this. I think I'm pulling it. The author is dead in my case for my view of this, perhaps. But I think the movie's about how Decker's a shitty cop, that he just shoots people in the back, that he's bad at detective work, that somebody tells him they're guilty and he goes there to execute them. He's not interested in the law.
I agree.
Yeah. And
I agree. He's a shitty cop, but he's also a boring cop.
Yeah. Well,
if he was like that Shield guy, Mr. Shield himself.
Yeah.
If he was like that, he'd be fun to watch. Yeah. But he's like a boring bad cop.
But yeah, I think like what he does to Zora, you're supposed to like Zora, or at least think she's like, oh, this is a pretty woman she's trying to get away from all this, and now she's on the run from him. He's not saving. She's not, like, threatening to kill somebody, and then he has a dirty, hairy moment of, like, I gotta save this kid and shoot her. Like, no. She is about to get away. He is shooting into open crowds of people. He could hit a civilian very easily. And again, this is what cops fucking do. Like, he shoots her in the back multiple times until he's definitely sure she's dead. So, and then when he has to have a fair fight against somebody, he sucks. Now, yes, they are much stronger Supermen, so sure, fine. They do say that Leon can lift 400-pound things, so he is very strong. He could have just ripped off Decker's arm, fine. But
I mean, for me, like I know this is, I keep quoting Homer Simpson, but like, it's just a bunch of stuff that happened. It doesn't have much narrative tissue beyond just like, wouldn't it be cool if this happened? Hey, here's some boobies. Oh, now he's looking at a photograph, but he's looking around the corner in a photograph. Huh? What?
I guess
it's cool, but it's dumb.
I guess the moral is the squeaky android gets the grease.
Yeah. Like, what if we went up in a big elevator? That would be cool. Look, here's a big elevator we built. I don't know. I really like it, but it really is just a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm. The description at the top of the show of this movie having 5 stars and vibes is very accurate. Because, it's visually appealing. I understand why so many things pulled from it. The music's great. The casting is great. The story is just like, here's an excuse to show you all of this lavish stuff that we put together for 2 hours.
Cool with that, It's a visual medium. I'm cool with that. If this movie played in theaters again near me, I would probably go and see it just for the spectacle,
It's cool. I just feel like there's more interesting stuff you could have done with the story, and I haven't seen the sequel, so it sounds like they did do some of the more interesting stuff in it, but,
Are we going to talk about 1998's Soldier, which is technically tied to Blade Runner? Paul W.S. Anderson's Soldier, are we gonna address that for 2 hours?
Stuart, in 30 seconds, Soldier, what's going on?
I don't know, I haven't watched it. It's a Paul W.S. Anderson movie, are you kidding me?
It was his follow-up to Mortal Kombat. He did that instead of Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Yeah. You're right.
Well, it could be worse. I guess it could have been Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
I mean, we do have to wrap up in a minute here. We could do an entire podcast series about what Blade Runner influenced, because it's just endless. But I will say, it's a video game podcast about old games. There's been, frankly, too many re-releases of Blade Runner. I'm done. That's it.
We need at least
one re-release of Snatcher. It is the video game that asks, what if Blade Runner was also Terminator? And I like that much more than Blade Runner. Because I love Blade Runner is fun to watch. It's fine. It's kind of middling for me. 2049, much better. Snatcher is a much better exploration of that kind of a world. And that's all Kojima likes. He doesn't even like gameplay. He's like, let me tell you how cigarettes work. Let me tell you how ramen works. It's all world building, and it's so fun. And yes, please pirate it. You'll never see it again. I think it's too close to Blade Runner to actually see release. I think they're watching things like that now. Sorry, Stuart.
I've got to say, just because you were just Snatcher, what a tease it was when they put out the TurboGrafx Mini and it had fucking Snatcher on it, and everyone's like, oh my god, Snatcher. And it's like, it's the Japanese version, there's no way to play it in English because it was never released in English on the PC Engine. Are you kidding me? Seriously, please go out and pirate it. Don't even delete it after 24 hours. It doesn't matter.
Just go
and play the goddamn game. If they won't sell you it, then what are you supposed to do?
The last time anyone made money off of Snatcher was 1994 in America, so I can't help you there. PayPal, ask Kojima and ask what his Venmo is. Drop him like $3.
Yes, send him the money. It's a great game. Please play it.
I do love the impact of Blade Runner more than, Cowboy Bebop. There is no Cowboy Bebop without Blade Runner, and it's better than Blade Runner in every way, and Shinichiro Watanabe loves it. And made a Blade Runner anime, even like a short film tied into 2049, which is also really good. It's definitely the Kojima generation of otaku who are now like reaching 60. Like these mostly guys, but men and women, they saw these Blade Runner and other movies too, and just were like, I want to make something as cool as this, or even cooler, and tell my own story, tell my own bubblegum crisis style story. And then we see the anime of stuff like that, or Ghost in the Shell, and then that gets put into every Western video game. And so it's mirrors reflecting on itself of the long tail of Blade Runner, to the point now where if you were to make, if somebody licensed Blade Runner the video game, it would just be reviewed as, what a ripoff of Cyberpunk, and it's not half as good as Cyberpunk,
they wouldn't put the money into it.
Ultimate Blade Runner bit, like the similar video game, would be Future Cop LAPD, which is really Blade Runner vibes, and it's a great game, so play that.
A better cyberpunk film as well from, 6 years later is Robocop. Robocop is a perfect
movie.
Hell
yeah.
Yeah.
And hey, also just watch Total Recall. It's fun. Kevin, any final words?
No, I was just going to say, it's fascinating just the weird stuff you see that pulls from Blade Runner, like something like Perfect Dark's kind of on the nose. Perfect Dark's just 100% taking that Blade Runner world. And but then you get into weird stuff like Super Mario Brothers, the 93 live action movie.
Oh,
like
my
the,
God.
The King, like the King Koopa City. It just is pure Blade Runner in its
didn't
visual
like
design.
Didn't reuse some production stuff from as well, right? I'm sure I read that somewhere.
Yeah, and like, I realized it last night watching it. The King of Fighters games from like 99 to like 2001 or so, they introduce a lot of weird cyberpunk stuff that is super like Blade Runner-esque in terms of, you know, these characters and their backstories and everything. So
the entire Mega Man X series as well, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. It's just, I
and
feel
that
like
one leveling Gex Teep Gather Gecko.
Blade Runner, the movie, is now in the shadow of basically Blade Runner, the art style, where just like, my game is Blade Runner. And then it's just like, I guess there was a movie once called Blade Runner, but hey, look at my new game or my new movie or my new comic or whatever. But thanks for joining us, folks. This has been another episode of Retronauts. You can find us on Twitter at Retronauts. And of course, this whole podcast is supported by great fans like you listeners out there. If you want to support the show and get these episodes 1 week at a time and ad-free, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. Sign up for $3 a month to get just that, but you want to really be at the $5 level because that will get you two exclusive full-length bonus podcasts every month. And we've been doing this since the beginning of 2020, so I dare say we're getting close to about 100 full-length bonus episodes that you haven't heard if you're not a patron at that $5 level at patreon.com/retronauts. And that will also get you access to a weekly column and podcast by contributor Diamond Fight. So the second you sign up, you can access all of those that you haven't heard before if you're not a patron at patreon.com/retronauts. Let's go around the virtual room here, and we could talk about where we can find you folks online and what you're working on currently. Kevin, where can we find you?
So I am on Blue Sky and currently still Twitter under Ubersaurus. I have a YouTube channel called Atari Archive where I am going through the Atari VCS 2600 library game by game and delving into the history and context of each release. I just released a book a few months ago on the same topic through Limited Run Games, so check that out. And I'm supported on that through a Patreon, patreon.com/AtariArchive.
And Stuart, how about you?
Hi there. Yes, I'm also on Twitter and Blue Sky. Twitter at Stupacabra, Blue Sky, StuartJip.BlueSky.whatever that crap you have to write, I don't even know. It's all just ruins on Twitter, but I don't really post on Blue Sky, so whatever. I just got a book out as well called All Games Are Good, and it came out through Limited Run Games. It's almost as if there's some sort of collusion going on here. But what it's about is it's a collection of writing by me about all of the stupid bullshit crap licensed games that I love to death. All the stuff, the Tiny Toons games, your weird Gex games, all that stuff, the stuff that really does mean a lot to me, sort of coming from a lifetime playing all the wrong games at all the wrong times because you didn't have the consoles necessary to be up to date. It's lots and lots of fun, and yeah, you can get it through Limited Run Games. You can also hear me on Retronauts, and I also have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/StuartJip, and that's mostly for my comic, which I won't talk about.
And Henry, how about you?
You can follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. I'm on Instagram and Blue Sky as well. And, you know, I'm sure Elon Musk likes to think he's a Tyrell type guy, but I hope that he's like that fictional character in just one specific way that happens in the movie. But
oh, wait, yeah. cool glasses, right?
Yeah, he should have just as cool glasses. Yeah.
Okay, I thought so.
But yes. Of course, if you like hearing me and Bob talk about movies or other media, you should definitely be a listener to the Talking Simpsons network of podcasts. We go through every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order. We're in season 14/4 right now, bouncing between the two. And we do the What a Cartoon podcast, where we talk about an animated series. Each week, a brand new one with a super deep history like this podcast did for Blade Runner. You can find those all where you find free podcasts. And we are supported by patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, where we have a ton of exclusives of us covering King of the Hill and Futurama once every month. And a What a Cartoon movie of us going super deep into films, including, say, 6.5 hours on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Or, say, if you like our little cyberpunk talk here, check out our ones on Ghost in the Shell and Cowboy Bebop the movie. That's all at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
And as for me, I've been your host for this one, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky as Bob Servo. And I also have a book. If you're not tired of buying books by this point in the plugs, you can check out my book. It's the Boss Fight Books volume on Day of the Tentacle, the classic LucasArts point-and-click adventure game. They released my full oral history on the making of the game just in time for the 30th anniversary of Day of the Tentacle. You can find that at the Boss Fight Books website or wherever you find fine books around you. But that's been it for this Retronauts. We'll see you again next time, everybody. Take care.